Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So a rising PLO star and his rabbi mentor sat down for Passover dinner. Nope, it's not a joke. It's the real thing. In this hour, one of the leading voices of the PLO and his boyhood mentor, a prep school rabbi, sit down with us and talk openly and intimately about respect and love in a time of something like war. We begin in Israel, where today Palestinian suicide bombers set off two blasts, one at a restaurant in an upscale community near Tel Aviv, and a second under a school bus near a Jewish settlement on the West Bank. The violence comes on the heels of new raids by Israeli forces into Ramallah and statements by President Bush that drastic changes in the Palestinian Authority are needed before progress toward peace can be made. Bush made those remarks following meetings with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Last weekend, the American president met with Egypt's president, Hosni Mubarak, who pushed for swift recognition of a Palestinian state. Earlier, I spoke with Harvey Morris, reporter for the Financial Times, in Jerusalem, and asked how these meetings and Washington's posture are being received in Israel and the occupied territories.
Well, I think inevitably they've been better received in Israel than they have in the Arab world, because the position that President Mubarak put forward was pretty much rebuffed by Mr. Bush. And when Ariel Sharon went there, the president seemed to be more or less in agreement with what he put forward. There was no real clash of ideas there.
The Egyptian and Israeli leaders' views are so divergent, it would seem to leave things at a point of stalemate. But is there an expectation that the United States can now or will now dive in and somehow push the agenda ahead?
Well, that's the expectation and the hope, because we've been hearing a lot lately about a major speech that in which either Secretary of State Powell or President Bush will put forward America's position on this situation. It seems as if President Bush is very reluctant to give any sort of detailed plan, which would say, you know, how things are divided up and how you resolve issues such as Jerusalem and refugees. So the expectations aren't very high of what this will bring. I think the problem is at the moment that, at least as seen from this end, there seems to be a divergence of opinion within the administration about how to push things forward. And there was a bit of confusion after Mr. Sharon's visit as to who was putting the correct policy, because what President Bush said was slightly at odds with what was said afterwards.
In what nuance, Harvey Morris?
Well, I think the thing is that until now, or until very recently, the United States has been going along with this linear approach. In other words, they agree with the Israelis that you have to have calm on the ground, you have to combat terrorism, and then you move on to so-called confidence-building measures. This is what we had with the so-called Tenet plan and then the Mitchell plan. I think what's been coming up since, particularly from the State Department, is an idea that you should do things in parallel. In other words, you try and get the Palestinians to crack down on terrorism. At the same time, you hope they'll reform their security services and that they'll reform their economy, and that there will be some move forward to a diplomatic approach. In the comments that President Bush made after his meeting with Mr. Sharon, it seemed to be from this end that he was still pushing a sort of linear approach. He was making a very strong point that terrorism must be combated and that Yasser Arafat is not doing his job so far. I think when he makes his expected speech, maybe things will clarify a bit more than they are now.
It seemed as though there may have been some retreat from the parallel process mode there. There was such a crescendo of conflict and drama just 6 or 8 weeks ago. What's playing out on the ground now, Harvey Morris, as these conversations go on in Washington and other capitals?
Well, I think there's perhaps a false perception that things have got much quieter here. We've got beyond the big invasion of April, obviously, but now the Israelis are going in on a daily basis to Palestinian territory. And because it's become so much the norm, I think perhaps it doesn't quite have the drama that it did when they had a full-scale invasion. At the same time, the tightening of security around Palestinian areas has increased a lot. And that's understandable from the Israeli point of view, because there still are bombings, the most recent being today. And the invasion of itself hasn't obviously provided a solution to that threat.
Is there a sense that something has been gained by all the violence and drama of the last few months, or are we just back in a kind of stalemate?
Well, I think that perhaps the Israeli government feels that it's gained something, because there has been a diminution of attacks, although they still happen with frightening regularity. I think also Mr. Sharon has gained a lot of popular support. That may start to wear a bit thin if they can't do more to stem the attacks, because now, after all, Israel has taken over responsibility for security in the Palestinian areas. So I suppose if bombers get through, then the day will come when Israel gets the blame rather than the Palestinians for this still continuing.
Does Sharon's new popularity mean that Israelis have turned away from interest in a settlement, interest in a Palestinian state?
I think the thing is, at the moment, that if one can judge Israeli public opinion correctly, I think that as long as attacks continue, they're not prepared to see anything which might be interpreted as a concession or a weakening in the face of terrorism. And in that sense, the continued incursions into the territories do seem to be fairly popular.
And on the Palestinian side, is Yasser Arafat indeed marginalized in some degree compared to where he was 6 months ago?
He's marginalized in the sense that clearly he doesn't have the capacity to do what he was supposed to be doing before, and which the Israelis and the Americans say he wasn't doing, which was to control militants. But his popularity seems to be holding up. I mean, you don't get demonstrations in the street in his favor in the Palestinian territories, because people are very worn down by the situation that they're in. But in the latest opinion poll yesterday, you know, he still seems to be trusted by at least the largest number of Palestinians.
And if Israelis feel, to some extent at least, that the show of force has worked, has been effective, what lessons have the Palestinians taken away from the last 3, 5, 6 months?
They don't seem any less radical in their attitudes than they were before. I mean, thankfully, there is a reduction in the number that support suicide bombings, but still a large amount of people do support these tactics. They're obviously wanting to see reforms in the Palestinian Authority as much as outsiders are. And the moves that have been made so far towards reform haven't really tackled the internal demand for reform. They've been more gestures aimed at persuading, principally Washington, I think, that something's happening.
Harvey Morris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is a reporter with the Financial Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. With tensions at an endless breaking point in Israel and the West Bank, you might not think tonight's guests, a rising PLO star and a retired rabbi, would want to be in the same room, let alone around the same dining room table. But that's where Michael Tarazi and Rabbi Everett Gendler have been since the 1970s, when they met on the campus of Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. Rabbi Gendler was a Jewish chaplain there, and Michael was a student who didn't even know for years that he was a Palestinian American. Their friendship has survived the years, and perhaps even more remarkable, the turmoil in the Middle East. Michael, a Harvard Law School graduate and longtime Wall Street lawyer, is now legal advisor and frequent spokesman for the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And he's talking tough about what he calls Israeli racism and oppression, about Palestinian yearning for freedom, and more. Tonight, he joins us and his old friend and mentor, Rabbi Gendler, to talk it all out. Can the Israeli-Palestinian conflict be discussed in the spirit of friendship instead of suspicion? And how do personal relationships survive terrible political passions? What does the world gain or lose when a Palestinian and his old rabbi mentor talk about the conflict? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington is Michael Tarazi. Good evening and welcome, Michael Tarazi.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And from his Massachusetts home, Rabbi Everett Gendler. Good evening, Rabbi Gendler.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, gentlemen.
Michael Tarazi, it's been a long road. Take us back to this friendship with Rabbi Everett Gendler. It's an extraordinary story. It seems to defy world events, and we're glad for that. I guess maybe the starting point is here today, getting on 20 years after your prep school years. What does Rabbi Gendler mean to you?
Rabbi Gendler for me is first of all a friend, and over the course of the last 20 years has actually become family. One of the things that we haven't mentioned is that I'm not only very good friends with the rabbi and value him not only as a mentor and a friend, but his entire family as well. His wife Mary, their daughters Tamar and Naomi, who I've been friends with now also since our high school years. And whenever I come back from the occupied Palestinian territories and I experience the horrors that I experienced there, and I come back and I visit the rabbi or I visit his daughters, I'm always brought back to the fact that this is fundamentally between human beings, and we have to not lose sight of that. And I think that helps me a great deal in the work that I do.
Rabbi Gendler, we're trying to focus on that human relationship tonight. Share with us what Michael has meant to you over the years. You indeed see him as family?
Completely. Adopted family, which means choice family, not simply imposed on us by accident of birth, but a delight, a human delight as a person. And the sense of affection and, as Michael says, this humanity that we share so obviously has been really sustaining. And of course, as I've watched him on his rather improbable trajectory, I don't know if it's upward mobility, it certainly is meandering mobility, I've kveld, as we say in Yiddish. I've taken great pride in seeing this human being unfold and assume serious responsibilities while still maintaining that delightful mirth in relation to life.
And now, Michael Tarazi, you find yourself just last week on page one of the Wall Street Journal, heralded as the rising star of the PLO, a humane but very tough spokesman for the Palestinians. We'll get into that, but take us back first. You were a student at Andover, one of the country's elite prep schools, alma mater of President Bush. How exactly did you meet Rabbi Gendler? Tell us about that relationship then and over the years.
You know, I knew you were going to ask this question. I was trying to think back, and I don't really recall. But I
you were 13, now don't forget, or 14. Sorry.
It was 20 years ago at the age of 15, 1982. Right. But as I recall, I think it happened through his daughters. And I was friends with his daughter Naomi and then his older daughter Tamar. And, you know, they were known as the faculty brats because their rabbi father was the Jewish chaplain at the school. And we really just became friends, and through that, I believe I met the rabbi through my sort of honorary membership in the Jewish Students Union. I mean, I recall playing, you know, spinning the dreidel with the Jewish students. For some reason, those were all of my friends, and remarkably, many of them are still my friends to this day.
And Rabbi Gendler, you actually, when Michael learned that he was in fact a Palestinian American, you encouraged him to go to Israel and the occupied territories, perhaps even chipped in to make that trip possible.
I had that privilege, yes.
What was on your mind when you encouraged this young man to do exactly that?
Nothing specific, but one of the wonderful things about the ecumenical chaplaincy at Phillips Academy in Andover was the way in which, as chaplains, we most directly served our immediate faith community, but we also felt related to everyone on campus who had spiritual questions, who was in search, striving. So here this young man comes, and he's just discovering that he is Palestinian. Wow, you know, the identity issue. Mm-hmm. And more than just ethnic belonging, value questions as well. And, you know, internally I said, look, this is like all the Jewish students that I deal with. And how wonderful it would be if he were able to establish connections with his roots, with his community of origin, how wonderful it would be if he could discover some of the sustaining elements of that community.
Rabbi Gendler, if you can hold it there, we have to take a short break. We're going to take this through the tough questions. We're so glad you're with us tonight. Listeners, can the Israeli-Palestinian relationship be discussed not at a level of hatred and suspicion, but of deep friendship, even love? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with a rising PLO star and his rabbi mentor. It's a story in a way of love and war or something like it. We're joined by Michael Tarazi. He's a Palestinian-American lawyer, a legal advisor, and frequent spokesman today for the PLO. And by Rabbi Everett Gendler. He is chaplain emeritus at Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. And by you, if you'd like to join us. The question is, can the Israeli-Palestinian relationship be discussed, not at a level of hatred, but of deep friendship, even love? And what do you hear when the PLO man and the rabbi wrestle with the issues of the Mideast conflict? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rabbi Gendler, you were talking about Michael's first understanding and reaching out to understand his own Palestinian identity and your role in getting him to Israel and to, I guess, the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did he come back fired up? Did you think when you saw him come home that this might one day emerge as a global, certainly an American, big-time spokesman for the Palestinians?
Such powers of foresight I did not have. I wish I could claim them. But Michael did come back deeply affected, and I know that he wanted desperately to share some slides and tell some tales of what he had experienced in those early days of the first and less violent intifada. So he certainly was affected by it. It was more than just a family visit, though that it was also.
And as you have watched the terrible dark clouds gather over this relationship between Israel and the Palestinians in subsequent years, Rabbi Gendler, what light or shadow does that cast on this friendship? What thoughts has it brought to you about the difficulty of sustaining friendships across such stormy lines?
Well, I think in a curious way, it hasn't been so difficult because for me there are certain principles that are primary. I mean, we loved having Michael with us at Seder's, and he joined in wonderfully. Great voice, as I say, infectious smile, a great sense of humor, and one wants a bit of levity along with the seriousness. But it was also quite poignant that the story of the Jewish redemption from Egypt echoed for Michael, so that over the years, when I've seen him become increasingly involved with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian struggle, I have understood his involvement and that struggle as similar to the struggle that the Jewish people experienced for its own freedom and self-determination and under divine guidance. And so there has always been the sense that the conflicts are somehow secondary to the essential, which is this slow struggle of all peoples to achieve what in Hebrew tradition we call the redemption from Egypt, from the tight place.
Michael Tarazi, what about those Passover Seders and their message of liberation? How did those meals and that very powerful Jewish message fall on your young and newly aware Palestinian ear?
Well, it was falling on a clean slate. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, I didn't realize that I was Palestinian until September of 82 when I had just started as a sophomore at Phillips Academy. So I was not only in a new environment, but I was also with a new identity. And I found myself sort of veering towards those people at the school who would most be able to relate to that identity. And of course, there were no Arab or Palestinian students at the time. And so I veered towards, predictably, the Jewish students. And so I actually had a great respect for the Jewish attachment to Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. I don't I've learned from that early experience with the rabbi and the Jewish students that he brought me in touch with, that there's no point in trying to deny that attachment. And I have a profound respect for that. And of course, that respect only intensified, during Passover Seders. But what I found was that I needed to also assert my attachment to that land as well, that I, as a Palestinian, was no more or less deserving to be there than a Jew. And so when I went that summer, I guess it was the summer of 83, for the first time, and actually came into contact with the facts on the ground, I was able really to understand both sides. And I think that's put me in a very unique position in this conflict. Mm.
Jack Beattie, this is an incredibly touching relationship. And yet when we step back and look at it in the context of the enormous storm of violence and acrimony that surrounds this larger relationship, it looks like a very tiny craft indeed.
Yeah, and a frail one, deep-rooted, and I think that'll help it on the stormy seas, but they are real. I think, by contrast, and there can be a story on the other side, so I'm not just making a one-sided statement, but I remember, by contrast, reading a terribly moving story about a man from Jerusalem who worked, had a shop on the West Bank, and who was beloved of his Palestinian neighbors. He was a Jewish man, and he helped people. He brought them. He drove them into work. He drove them back. People in the neighborhood would come to him with problems. Mm-hmm. He'd been there for years. He was assassinated, and not by the people in the neighborhood. They were as shocked as anyone else. But, you know, it was as if here was this beautiful man. Here were these people they trusted. They had this relationship, and this political polarization just killed it.
Not the first relationship crushed by this struggle. Michael Tarazi, 2 years ago you moved to Ramallah, and you have taken on a fairly heavy responsibility with the PLO since then. Can you describe your current work for us?
I joined a team of lawyers. I'm a lawyer by training. And actually, at the time that I made the decision to return to my homeland, I actually thought there would be a Palestinian state. In fact, that's what motivated me. I, like many around the world, was very encouraged by the discussions at Camp David and a lot of talk about how we're so close, we've never been so close. And I made the decision that I wanted to go back and help develop the new Palestinian state. Well, that didn't happen. And unfortunately, I had already left my position as a lawyer in Europe, and I decided that I was still going to go, and I decided this would, of course, just be temporary, a spate of violence, that it wouldn't derail all the progress that's been made. And I found myself working in Ramallah as a lawyer, because I thought perhaps that was how I could help build the Palestinian legal system, and found myself working with a negotiation support unit, which was a team of lawyers like myself, Palestinians educated abroad who made the decision to return to their homeland to help any way they could. And my job originally was to provide support for the permanent status negotiations. But of course, we haven't had any negotiations for the last year and a half. And I found myself sort of becoming more and more of a communications expert and just trying to get the message out. Because growing up here in the United States, I understood that very few people really understood what it meant to live under occupation or what the Palestinian position was. And I got there and I said, well, why aren't we talking about what exactly happened at Camp David? Because everyone thinks that we were offered everything we ever wanted. And so I encouraged the Palestinians to be more public about, you know, the details of Camp David, more public about, you know, what our positions are, because I'm very proud of our positions. I think they're very reasonable positions.
And now,
and that's why I found myself where I am.
Mm-hmm. And you find yourself heralded in the Wall Street Journal as the most articulate and sophisticated Palestinian advocate to come along in years. Let's get into the meat of this, because friendship is wonderful, but what is ultimately fascinating here is how it survives in the really tough, rough and tumble of this conflict. You have written and spoken in this conflict of Israeli racism. You have written, of course, of Israel as an occupying power that desires to colonize and expel Palestinians. You've written about terrorism and violence in a way that condemns it, but at the same time, you've written, we must recognize that it is simply the system, not the symptom, not the disease. These are tough words and not exactly compromising words. What is your fundamental view of the conflict as it stands now?
Well, this is a conflict between two national movements on the same land. And I think that one of the what makes my job so easy is that I'm not ashamed of our positions. We have talked openly in the PLO, and we have become public about what our positions are. We are only asking for an end to the occupation of the Palestinian territory that was occupied in 1967. That only constitutes 22% of historic Palestine. And on the refugees, which is the second component of any permanent status agreement, a just and equitable solution that allows them to choose for themselves what kind of future they want to have. I don't think those are so controversial.
Rabbi Gendler, when you hear Michael Tarazi describe that position, you know that it falls on many Israeli ears and American Jewish ears as an unwelcome kind of proposal. How do you receive it?
Right. What I know is that it also falls on many Israeli ears and many American Jewish ears as a very welcome proposal. And when I hear talk of the 1967 borders, that says to me that UN Resolutions 242 and 338 are part of the assumption of the resolution of this dispute. In other words, the modifications of the Palestinian covenant over the years have had some effect on Palestinian attitude. And there's recognition that before 67, you do not go. Now, that is a substantial concession. So for somebody who, along with many Israelis and many American Jews, deplore the occupation, we have common ground there. I think the common ground is far broader than is recognized simply because of the surrounding vituperation. Michael's and my relationship is very special, granted. But I think that there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, who would find these commonalities in broader areas than is immediately evident from the headlines. Now, I should say something about Michael's use of the term racism. I should say that the most thoughtful of Zionists experience some qualms at ethnic definitions of a state. They experience some misgivings at ethnic preferences. Look, all of us who care about democracy are, in a sense, heirs of the French Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And the Enlightenment didn't know from group identity. It was radically individualistic. Now this new element has come on the scene, or let's say this ancient element has reasserted itself, a powerful need seen everywhere in the world for traditional group affirmations. I think there are kinder terms than racism. There is, if one wants to speak of a Jewish state, there is necessarily that favoring of one particular group. And I think it incontestable that that raises some real issues. So though Michael's term may be a bit incendiary, the flame that it lights does illuminate a genuine quandary.
Michael Tarazi, how about it? Your mentor calls for kinder words. Do you step back from the word racism?
Well, I guess I should never have used it in the first word because Rabbi Gendler and I are technically the same race. In fact, we're both Semitic. And so I shouldn't use the word racism, not because it's incendiary, but simply because it's inaccurate. But what I should use is that it's discriminatory. I think that what Rabbi Gendler talked about is what many Israeli Jews talk to me about, because I do make an effort to reach out to Israeli Jews as well by going into Tel Aviv and even Herzliya, where today's bombing was. I have a very good friend there who's invited me to her home to address audiences. And we often get Israelis who say, look, on the geographic component, yes, we believe in the 67 borders. It's only 22%. We don't have a qualm with you on that. We should have withdrawn years ago. But on the issue of refugees, We're not interested in hearing about it. This is what it means to be a Jewish state. We're sorry it happened.
Meaning we don't want a wave of Palestinians returning to Israel proper.
But what they're really saying is we don't want these non-Jews to return to our Jewish state. And this is where the discussion of discrimination comes up, because I don't do it to inflame. I don't do it to upset. I don't do it to point at fault. I do it because I think we don't do ourselves a service by trying to ignore what is the reality, which is I'm being asked to tell a Palestinian refugee that you have to give up your right to go home because you're not the right religion. And that's a very tough sell for me as a leader within the PLO. And I'm saying it because we have to understand what's being asked of us in order to understand how difficult it is to deliver on that.
Michael Tarazi, a lot of listeners want to join us, and I want to bring them in before we get to the next break. We're talking with Michael Tarazi, a Palestinian spokesman for the PLO, and Rabbi Everett Gendler. What do you think? Can two old friends, a Palestinian star and his rabbi mentor, take us closer to truth and the roots of this conflict, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling to set into contrast the fact that here are two individuals who are great friends.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, their collective societies have a clash of interests. And my contention is that it is collective groups, groups as a whole, that have interests and have clashes. And that's what conflict is made of, and I'm not sure whether individual friendship can impinge on it. I will give you an example of India and Pakistan. I come from India,
mm-hmm.
and Indians and Pakistanis speak the same language, actually eat the same food, hear the same music, but wait till the conversation comes to Kashmir.
And then watch out. Jay, you raise a wonderful point. I want to put it to Rabbi Gendler. You heard it at the same time we did, Rabbi. Is this friendship, in a sense, irrelevant when put up against the collective interests of Palestinians and Israelis?
No, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, nothing could make it irrelevant. You see, one might question the reality of so-called group interests. I can identify individuals. I know feeling when it's expressed. Others are perhaps better at detecting group spirit. So we need to keep track of what is real. Friendship is real. Human individuals are real. But is this irrelevant to the conflict? I think not. It seems to me that what can emerge from people like Michael and me being able to discuss this, my saying, gee, racism is a bit incendiary, and Michael saying, no, as a matter of fact, I'm talking about what I have to say to the Palestinian who is denied a return to his old olive grove. I think that as we can keep it in human terms, we can discover the human needs, which will not be totally satisfied. Well, look, the occupant of that olive grove, of that orange grove, is somebody who barely escaped from a family, most of which was exterminated in the gas chambers, and whose associations with memories of the homeland were like the Palestinians, except, you know, pre-existent.
Except you're, well, Rabbi Gendler, hold it there. We've got to take a short break. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the PLO star and his rabbi mentor, a story of love and war. If you picked up the Wall Street Journal last week, you would have seen on page one the smiling face of Michael Tarazi. In this headline, meet Michael Tarazi, a Harvard Law grad and PLO emissary. The Journal story goes on to describe Mr. Tarazi as perhaps the most articulate young Palestinian spokesman in the world today, presenting the kind of face to the world that Palestinians have not often been able to muster, and speaking with the persuasiveness that sets him apart in that realm. We're talking with him tonight along with his boyhood mentor and lifelong friend, Rabbi Everett Gendler, at whose Passover Seder he sat many years ago at Phillips Andover, and it sounds as tonight would still sit today. What do you think? What do you hear when the PLO man and the rabbi wrestle with the Mideast conflict? What's gained when a Jew and a Palestinian open their hearts to one another? Is anything lost? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ivan is on the line. Welcome, Ivan. You're on the air.
Good evening, Michael. First of all, congratulations. And the first time I saw you on TV, I got really happy. I got excited. Finally, we could see an American-Palestinian face, meaning that you could present a point of view and alter the parameters of the discussion, which has been controlled by the Israeli point of view, by the Jewish point of view. So, and I find it that what I find amazing about this friendship and the circumstances is the fact that you might be able to be a friend here in the States, but although I'm not Palestinian nor am I Israeli, I find it remarkable that you could go into an Israeli city like Tel Aviv and still maintain friendships with the people that oppress your people, and that you are magnanimous. I find that extremely interesting, because it's easy to come to a neutral territory like the States and be able to maintain that old friendship. But at the same token, I got to say that I grew up with Colombian Jews. I'm Colombian, and I always had a predilection for Jewish people. And yet as I grew up, and I'm married to a daughter of a Holocaust survivor, I find that I find the Palestinian people, the aggrieved people, and the people who haven't been able to present their case to history.
Ivan, thanks for your point. I want to put it to Michael Tarazi. Michael, here comes the skepticism. You can have this friendship in the leafy campus of Phillips Andover, born and rooted there. But what about when you sit down in the mean streets in the Middle East?
Mm-hmm. Well, he raises a very good point, and I thank him for his comments. But he does point out that I mentioned earlier that I do have similar friendships, although certainly not as long-standing nor quite as dear to me as the one I have with the rabbi and his family, but with Jews inside Israel as well. In fact, one who lives in Herzliya, where today's bombing took place. The reason I'm able to do that, and again, this is why I think I have a unique position in this conflict, is because as an American citizen, I can travel between Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories freely, and I'm one of the few people who actually does that.
And yet, Michael Tarazi, you come out and you're very critical of Israel at large. You've said colorfully, how do you divide a pizza with someone who won't stop eating it? It sounds funny on the surface, but it really goes to fundamental issues of trustworthiness of the Israeli state.
Absolutely.
Which is a collection of individuals.
No, be careful there. I'm never going to say the Israeli state. I will talk about Israeli policies, its construction of illegal settlements
fair
in
enough.
Occupied Palestinian
fair.
Territories. Fair. But I have lots of Israeli friends and still lots of Jewish friends and people who I've been able to come and convince to come visit me in Ramallah so that they can experience what I've experienced of humanizing both sides of this conflict. At the same time, though, I think we have to be very clear. These are not two equal parties. This is a conflict between an occupier and the people it occupies and oppresses. And I think the more Israelis get a chance to interact with Palestinians, the more they realize that we are just as human and just as deserving of our freedom and independence as they are. The problem inside Israel right now is that you don't have people meeting each other. It's a very segregated society, even within Israel itself, with the Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship. Most Israeli Jews don't count Palestinians among their friends the way the rabbi would count me among his friends and family. And I think that's a real problem in the Middle East. They live very close to each other, but really don't even know each other.
Jack Beatty, realms of great conflict have never been easy on friendships. The Cold War crushed many, and it wasn't the first conflict to do that.
No, that's certainly true, especially in the age of national movements, of peoplehood. But, you know, Michael, when you lay out the terms of things, you know, you're talking understanding, but when you brought up the refugees, you said, you know, why can't these people return? Well,
that's right.
You know, that is really asking for the one-state solution, isn't it? I mean, because if they return in time, it will not be a Jewish state. And a people has a right, indefeasible right, to decide what its state will be. And by talking about return, you're saying no.
Mm-hmm. This is where I ask the difficult questions, and I think we have to be careful about questions that I ask versus solutions that I pose. I ask the difficult questions, as I mentioned earlier, because it's very important for people to understand how Palestinians view this. When you are saying that a people, it has to be a Jewish state, and my first question is, well, what does that mean? Does that mean the right to discriminate against Christians and Muslims? If that's what you want, then say it openly. Don't talk about a Jewish state unless you're talking about the facts behind a Jewish state. And if we're talking about the right of a people, such as Israel, to, you know, decide who can and cannot be citizens. I mean, look, you are denying my connection to this land the way many Palestinians unfairly deny Jewish connection to this land. I am from Palestine. My grandmother is from Jaffa, just south of Tel Aviv. Mm. Explain to me why I can't go home, and I want to hear an answer. I don't think that's an unfair question. But once we pose that question, I think we can then understand why it's so difficult for us to just simply say, sorry, no refugee can ever return, even though they have that right under international law. And that's why I believe that we need to solve this issue of the refugees, not through a full-scale implementation of the right of return tomorrow. We understand that, and President Arafat himself said in an op-ed piece in the New York Times earlier this year that he understands Israel's demographic concerns, but we also understand the right of return for Palestinians. So we've talked about various options, you know, letting them stay where they are for those who prefer to stay where they are, let them go to a third country, let them return to a Palestinian state, provided that it's big enough and viable enough to absorb them.
But Michael Terezi, doesn't this sound like the kind of sweetly camouflaged version of the fear of Israelis that Palestinians will not recognize the fundamental right for them to be there, that the Mediterranean seashore still beckons?
I think that's very unfair. I have absolutely no problem with the Jewish connection to this land. And I think that most Palestinians themselves would say, look, this isn't about getting rid of Jews. It's a question of, do Jews have an exclusive right to this land? And I haven't really heard a good answer to that. Why do Jews have more rights to be there than I do?
Valerie's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Valerie. You're on the air.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Mr. Terezi, I think you are extremely articulate. Extremely articulate, and I appreciate this discussion, but a few points I'd like to make. Okay. One is, you know, you keep talking about this land. First of all, let's put it into perspective. Israel is the size of New Jersey, first of all. Second of all, there are 24 Arab countries. Jordan in and of itself is 60, over 60% of it is Palestinian. So Israel is the size of New Jersey, a teeny-weeny little place. You have the right, and you do. You go into Israel and you talk to Israelis in Herzliya and in Tel Aviv. How many? Could this rabbi actually go into Ramallah and speak to people? No, because the reason why is because there are he would be shot. I mean, the suicide bombers come in. Israelis cannot go to Israel and go to a restaurant, or they can't go to a grocery store without suicide bombers coming and harming them. I think, Mr. Terezi, I think what you need to do is you need to be speaking to the Palestinians. You sound like a very rational person. You sound like that you are you know, a very calm person. You need to be speaking to the Palestinians and explaining to the Palestinians that you have these friends that are Israelis and that have a point of view. Let's put it into perspective. I mean, Israel is a teeny-weeny little country.
Valerie, we got it. Michael Terezi, what about it? What is the toughest message that you carry to Palestinians in occupied territories?
Well, if I could, I'd like to just address a few of the points that she made, though. I mean, she said that Israel is the size of New Jersey. She's absolutely right, but she's also including the occupied Palestinian territories in that. And you have to remember the occupied Palestinian territories are less than a third the size of Israel. So she complains about how small, you know, the state of Israel is, and, you know, by that same logic, I can complain about how small the state of, you know, Palestine will
be. But the suggestion in Valerie's comments was that, well, you've got all of Jordan next door. Why not take advantage of it?
And I think this is extraordinarily provocative statement because what she's doing is the equivalent of saying that you as an Arab don't have any particular rights to this land. You just go, you're an Arab. You just go anywhere else the Arabs are. And I think that's extraordinarily provocative. It denies me my connection to be there. This is the equivalent of when a Palestinian says, these Jews have no right to be here. They came from Russia. They came from Europe. They came from New York. This has never been a Jewish land. It was 2,000 years ago. And I get extraordinarily angry with those people. When she says, what message do you take to them? That's one of the messages I take to them, that Jews have a right to be here. This isn't about trying to exclude Jews. This is about asserting our rights to be here as equals as well.
But you said Israel has made it very clear that its goal is to colonize more Palestinian land while ridding itself of the Palestinian population.
Correct.
Tough.
But true. I mean, Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, according to Israeli human rights organizations, now control almost 42% of the occupied Palestinian territories, which, as we've already pointed out, is only 22% of historic Palestine. So there's very little left for the Palestinians. And that's the kind of measures taken on the ground that undermines Palestinian confidence in Israeli intentions. I don't see how anyone can possibly disagree with that.
Rabbi Gindler, what do you think when you hear Michael Tarazi say that Israel's made it clear that its goal is to colonize more Palestinian land and rid itself of the Palestinian population? Do you agree with that interpretation of Israeli intent?
I think that there is a split among the Israelis. I think that there are certainly those who, in fact, would like to maintain hold on the settlements permanently. And I was dismayed when Prime Minister Sharon a couple of weeks ago said Hazera is exactly like Tel Aviv. I mean, that being a tiny settlement in the remote stretches of the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a serious and at this point dominant Israeli faction that would keep hold of the land. I think there is a huge segment. Polls have shown that both among Israelis and Palestinians, there are substantial, or at least there were substantial bodies of opinion that recognize, let me put it this way, the poignancy of what Michael articulates. Yes, those people displaced have a claim. And yes, the refugees from Europe and from many Arab lands, they also have a claim. And in matters of space, unlike spirit, claims cannot be universally accommodated. There's going to be some painful renunciation on both sides. I think it would help immensely if Israel could acknowledge some responsibility for the plight of the Palestinians. It would be appropriate, incidentally, for those who were in charge of the so-called occupied territories from 48 to 67 to explain how it happened that under their jurisdiction there was no Palestinian entity. But I think there needs to be, for Michael to take back to those people, there needs to be acknowledgement of their claim. The regretful acknowledgement that it cannot fully be met, but that compensation, assistance for alternatives, and at least some reuniting of families among those who live in Israel, all of that seems to me possible. I see no other approach. Could I just add, by the way, that when Michael spoke of what Jim Sleeper used to call the closest of strangers, the segregation within the Middle East, I was reminded of an extraordinary center called Open House in the Ramla, where young Jews and young Arabs actually have continued to meet, and a bunch of them are coming over to the U.S. this summer, even in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that communication continues, but
it's not the only relationship here that you have.
Yeah, beg pardon?
It's not the only relationship across this line that we're looking at tonight.
That's right. There are others that we're not so aware of.
Our time grows very short. Michael Tarazi, in just a couple of seconds, you are on a path with the PLO. Who knows where it will lead? There's a lot of blood and fire here. Do you have any fear that your relationship with Rabbi Gindler could at some point be endangered?
None whatsoever. This relationship is rock solid. I value the rabbi and his family greatly, just like they're my family. I enjoy spending time with them. I have never once felt in any way that they did not value me as a human being, and I value them just as much.
And with that, we're out of time. Michael Tarazi, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
And
Rabbi Everett Gindler, thank you so much for being on with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty.
And may I just say that, as with Michael, there is no such danger. And believe me, we work together so that everybody in the Middle East can have the kind of mutual respect and love that we enjoy.
And with that, we go. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded.